Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a clergy member on why she thinks Christian nationalism is a threat not only to democracy, but also to religion. And comedian Louis Black is back on the road and bringing his rants to Arizona. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
We were getting people notarizing at like 2 in the morning. You know, we had people meeting us at the Capitol, shoving petitions into boxes.
The time has come for us to put this into law. The date has passed. I am calling on Secretary Hobbs to expedite the signature verification project.
This reinstatement of this near total ban on abortion is wildly unpopular. It's also incredibly detrimental to people's health, their bodies, and their lives.
I think we all want consistency and certainty in the law. And ultimately, it is up to the governor and the legislature to make any changes they believe are necessary.
I will not prosecute any doctor, any pharmacist, any nurse for abortion.
I don't want to make the law. That's the job of the legislature. I enforce the law. And I think that's an important distinction between my opponent and myself.
And with me to talk about the ruling on Arizona's pre-statehood law banning most abortions, the ESA program going into effect, and more, our former gubernatorial candidate Christine Jones. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning.
And Julie Earfley of Earfley Uncuffed. Julie, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So let's start with the news from this morning. Secretary of State Katie Hobbs has officially said that Save Our Schools did not turn in enough petition signatures to refer the universal ESA expansion program to the ballot in 2024. That would have put the law on hold pending that vote. It now will go into effect. Christine, I guess, what do you make of the fact that the group was not able to collect enough valid signatures to refer this?
Well, first of all, my disclosures, I do serve on the board of a charter school network. So obviously this was a good day for us. And, you know, I've heard some things, Mark, about the delay and the signing of the legislation, that if they had had an extra 10 days, you know, maybe they would have gotten enough signatures. But frankly, and candidly, I was very surprised, because when I talked to people from Save Our Schools, after they turned in their signatures, they were pretty confident. And this turnabout where they said, oh, just hold on a second, we don't think we have enough, was actually really surprising to me. I do think it's a good day for school choice. I think it cements Arizona's position as the leader in school choice around the country. And this is going to give other states sort of a roadmap of how to do this same sort of empowerment scholarship paradigm, you know, where they are. So if you're a school choice advocate like I am, today was a good day.
Julie, what do you think? I mean, as Christine said, a lot of folks, sort of the conventional wisdom was Save Our Schools did this once before. No reason why they shouldn't be able to do it again.
Right. Well, if you recall, a few years ago when Save Our Schools was successful, people were in shock, because what most people believed was this is an extremely difficult thing to gather more than 100,000 signatures in less than 3 months. And people were falling all over themselves, congratulating SOS, because everybody gave them, you know, all of like 2% as far as chances about whether or not they could pull it off. And so I think this just goes to show that this is a very, very difficult feat. And it could be, my sense is that there was too much confidence by a lot of folks who maybe would have been involved, or maybe would have pushed a little bit harder, like, oh, they did this before, everything's going to be fine, they're going to do it again. And that may have been part of the problem, right, is that there just wasn't enough push to get this across the finish line. Plus, they faced opposition that they didn't have before. They literally had people heckling those who were gathering signatures, which was not something that they encountered before.
Well, Julie, it's an interesting point you bring up about how there was sort of an organized opposition, the decline to sign effort to try to convince people not even to sign the petitions, much less trying to go against the idea of you know, if it had made the ballot in opposition to that, this was an opposition campaign to get people not to sign. How much of a role do you think that played here?
I don't know that it discouraged people from signing, to be quite honest. I think it was discouraging to the folks who were out gathering signatures. I mean, I heard a lot of stories about people feeling like they were literally being heckled and bullied, and it was just a very confrontational situation. So I think it may have been more discouraging to those who were going around collecting the signatures versus those who were wanting to sign. I think most of the people who wanted to sign knew what they were signing for and were very happy to do so. But yeah, anytime you have opposition, that creates more barriers, of course. They're also, like I said, I do think though that the biggest issue here was that they're just, I think people became a little bit more complacent, like, oh, they did this before, they can do it again. And so I think there were probably not as many people who were pulling sheets and going out and making sure that they got those sheets filled.
So, Christine, the law now will go into effect. There, we have seen from the state education department, there are families who have already signed up. We know a little bit about who they are and where, you know, what their education system is now. So now that basically any public school student who wants one can, or any student who wants one can get an ESA, is that the end of this issue, do you think? Or you know, do you anticipate that this will continue to be a political talking point going forward?
Well, I want to echo Julie's sentiment about the Herculean effort of getting over 100,000 signatures in less than 90 days. I don't care what the issue is and where you stand on it. That is a massive deal. And so, you know, it's impressive. In terms of whether this is the end of the discussion, once the program goes into effect, it will be very difficult, if not impossible, to get a Republican legislature to change it, right? So I think we kind of are where we are. Because today is a deadline, and I who knows how hardened this website is to register, it may go down, right? So many people may apply that it literally could cause people not to be able to apply for the deadline today. But honestly, if you're talking about a Republican legislature who would have to take an action against what they've already done, it is really hard for me to conceptualize that happening. So I think kind of ESAs are the rule of the day in Arizona for the next foreseeable future. And parents are going to say, you know, I want my $7,000 and I want to spend it the way I want to spend it. And I think you're going to see a lot of exodus from the public schools, which as a public school child and, you know, and having my husband teaching in the public schools for the last 21 years also kind of breaks my heart, because I feel like if we're trying to make the public schools better, giving them, you know, sort of this bomb in the middle of the equation will not help them get better. It will make them worse.
Julie, let me ask you what you think about what the impact of this will be. We saw some of the early numbers were that the majority of families who applied for these were those who had students already in private schools, which became a talking point for some of the Save Our Schools folks. Do you expect a big exodus from public schools as well?
I don't know that there'll necessarily be a big exodus from public schools. I think the majority of the money is going to go to people who are already in private schools, never had any intention to go to public schools. So this is basically just going to be taking money out of the system that didn't need to come out of the system. And by the way, let's just clarify something. You didn't need an ESA to go to a private school. Like, we have choice in this state. We have plenty of choice. I think it's important for taxpayers to understand that when you're using public funds for private schools, these are schools that do not have to follow the same rules as public schools. They don't have to admit students with disabilities. They can pick and choose which students they accept. I just don't see how that issue goes away. And I do think, because we've already seen a lot of problems with where the money goes, you know, using money to, oh, I believe somebody used it to to pay for an abortion at one point. Remember that so many years ago? We've already had a lot of controversy about how people are using this money. There was like a bounce house or something that was advertising that, hey, you can use your ESA funds here. I think as voters become more aware of how this money is being used, public money, I think that may cause people to reconsider. But I do think that the long-term effect is going to be things getting much worse before they get better. And it kind of reminds me actually of the abortion situation, right? Where you had advocates who were saying for a long time, people want a complete and total ban, like believe them when that is what they are going for. And everybody just kind of poo-pooed that and said, oh, no, it'll never happen. It'll never happen. And then it happened. Well, I think it's the same thing with this. A lot of folks have been saying, education advocates, there are far too many Republicans who want to dismantle public education and make it for and make create two very unequal systems. And that is exactly what's happening right now.
Well, Julie, thank you for providing a segue to the next topic, which was going to be the first thing we talked about until the news this morning.
I was just going to say that. It was so smooth.
Julie, you have a bright future in radio production here. Christine, let me ask you about last Friday after the show, we should point out, so we didn't miss it last week, the Pima County judge decided that the injunction that had been blocking the pre-statehood ban, basically on most abortions, should be allowed to be lifted, meaning the law could go back into effect. That ruling, though, does not seem to have clarified all that much in the minds of people on both sides of this issue. I am not a lawyer. Can you explain why there's still so much confusion here?
Well, the judge, and this is Judge Johnson down in Pima, can only work with a very limited set of facts and law that she's presented with, right? So she was only deciding one issue. I personally, as a lawyer, think it made it more confusing, not less confusing. And I do think it's incumbent upon the legislature now to come and say, is the 15-week ban that we passed in the last cycle going to overrule this? Are the two going to peacefully coexist? I personally think that they need to clarify. Now, to Julie's point about the total ban, that doesn't appear to be popular with the majority of the population. So I do think that there's still going to be a focus on it, and the legislature is going to have to say, do we want to go ahead and implement the 15-week ban? Do we want to expand it to have exceptions? Or do we really want to have another Save Our Schools that's, you know, sort of the Save Our Abortion people that are going to go collect a bunch of signatures and make a constitutional amendment that will cement the right to abortion in Arizona going forward? I think it's very complicated and very confusing, and I hope the legislature gets in session to clarify this thing before the end of the year, because honestly, today as a lawyer, I couldn't give you advice on which rule you should be following.
Julie, we're going to go to a break in just a moment, obviously continue talking about this afterwards, but I want to ask you about what Christine said about this idea of a special session, because Mark Brnovich has called for a special session, which is maybe the only time that Democrats and Brnovich have been on the same page about anything in the last number of years. I hesitate to ask a cynical question related to politics, but like, is there any chance this close to an election that the governor calls a special session and that Republican lawmakers would agree on anything here?
Absolutely not. No, there's several things actually that Ducey could call a special session on, including lifting the spending cap on public schools. But no, he's absolutely not going to call a special session on this, because he knows, as Christine alluded to, 91% of Arizonans, 91% in a recent survey said that they disagree with a total ban. This is extremely unpopular. 100% of statewide Republicans running for office, for statewide office, disagree with the majority and want a total ban. And many of these legislative Republicans don't want to put that out in the open before an election. They don't want the voters to know that they are not on their side. They want something very different. So no, I do not see a special session happening at all.
All right. Much more on this in just a moment. That is Julie Earfley of Earfley Uncuffed, also joined by Christine Jones. You're listening to the Friday Newscap here on KJZZ. More in just a minute. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. My guest this morning, former gubernatorial candidate Christine Jones and Julie Earfley of Earfley Uncuffed. So, Christine, Julie, before the break, was talking about how there's basically no chance that there is a special session and how a lot of candidates don't really want to be talking about this issue. We have heard over the last number of weeks that at least among Democratic candidates, like the first, second, third, and maybe fourth issues that they want to talk about are abortion. How are Republican candidates, how should maybe they be talking about this issue, given the polling number that Julie referenced and given the fact that most Arizonans don't think a near total ban is the way to go?
Well, as a candidate, I think you have to focus on the issues that you can control and the issues that you can influence. And so you've naturally seen Republican candidates sort of, you know, shying away from this. Except to say I'm pro-life and I believe that, you know, when there is a fetus, it is a real life human being. And so I think they should be protected. Other than that, I see people pivoting away. And this issue, it, just as a former candidate, I think really goes to voter turnout. The Democrats obviously have used this effectively to say, this is a really important election and you must vote. I don't know that that's enough to overcome the enthusiasm of the Republicans, particularly when you see that every single Trump endorsed candidate won their primary. Their issue is not abortion, right? Their issue is the border and their issue is election integrity. So this may just come down to Julie's point, if the legislature doesn't come back, it really may come down to, we are going to talk about on the Democrat side, the fact that 90% of the population disagrees with this. And on the Republican side, we're going to talk about, we don't think your young people vote and we don't think you're going to come out. So we're going to win anyway.
Well, so Julie, it sounds like maybe this kind of goes back to the point you were making about Save Our Schools, where there maybe was a little bit of complacency there, thinking we did it before, we can do it again. From the Democratic perspective, what work has to happen to make sure that people who do care about this issue, but maybe aren't the most likely midterm voters, actually get out to the ballot?
Well, always in a midterm, and especially in an Arizona midterm, turnout. I mean, there just has to be a very large ground game. But I also think that with the candidates, and I do see them doing this, particularly the statewide candidates, but they have to be talking about abortion. In fact, I think that is where they need to focus their messaging right now, is on this issue, because they are with Arizonans on this issue, actually on a couple of issues, as we saw from some recent polls. But this one in particular, I do think that if the majority of Arizonans knew that, for instance, Carrie Lake and Abe Hamada and Mark Fincham are not in favor I should say that they are in favor of this territorial ban. They are not on board with where the rest of Arizonans want, where they believe that there should be exceptions and that abortion should be mostly legal. I think that that would motivate the majority of Arizonans to come out and vote. And I do think that that's something that they need to focus on, is just talking about this over and over and over and what it means, right? Because some of the things that we're trying to figure out is, you know, how close to death do women have to be before they're allowed to have an abortion? Even just recently, Bronovich was talking about the 24-hour waiting law. Oh, well, does a woman have to wait 24 hours if her life is in danger, but she's not going to die within 24 hours? Or can she have it right? I mean, there are so many questions. These are questions that should never be answered by Doug Ducey or Mark Bronovich or Carrie Lake. These are questions that most certainly should be answered by medical professionals, but are being taken out of their hands. And Arizonans need to understand that, and Democrats need to make that choice obvious and explain that to Arizonans, that literally women and girls will be harmed by this law.
Christine, abortion was clearly one of the big issues at the attorney general debate this week between a Democrat, Chris Mayes, and Republican, Abe Hamadeh. And, you know, there Chris Mays has been pretty clear about the fact that she would not prosecute physicians or pharmacists or anyone else related to abortion. And as we heard at the top of the hour, Abe Hamadeh said, look, you know, it's not the attorney general's job to make the laws or decide which ones to enforce. Like, it's their job to enforce the law. This is a race that has sort of been a little bit under the radar, given all the other high profile ones. Does this issue elevate the AG race at all, do you think?
If it doesn't, if it didn't before, it may now that we have this ruling, you know, from Pima County. I don't disagree with Abe Hamadeh. The attorney general's job is to enforce the law. Now, as a practical matter, what Rachel Mitchell said, as the county attorney, I'm not going to prosecute these doctors, or I'm not going to prosecute women, I think she said, that's really a more important statement, because these laws sound under state law. They really are going to go to the county attorneys for prosecution if there are prosecutions. But I do think it's important to hear what Abe said, which is, my role isn't a policy development role. My role is the state's lawyer. And so, and frankly, you know, him trying to say I'm super experienced in the courtroom is probably a losing strategy. Him understanding what the attorney general does is probably better for him to stand on. But you may see more attention. And to Julie's point, if every single Democrat is talking about this uniquely, somebody is going to have to pay attention to it, right? This may actually be enough to get Katie Hobbs to do a debate, right? Couldn't Katie Hobbs come out and do a 30-minute debate and say, all right, this is enough for me. I'm going to go out and explain to voters. I'm going to look in a TV camera and say, let me tell you why you should vote for me. I mean, if this isn't enough, I don't know what is. But I don't disagree with you, Julie. I do think that this is the right message for Democrats. And I think Republicans are going to have to try to stay away from it a little bit, including Abe. All he needs to say is, I'm going to do my job. I'm not going to make the law.
Well, Julie, what about that point? The fact that, you know, yes, there is prosecutorial discretion, and there has been a lot of discussion about how county attorneys are really sort of the main decision makers on this issue, as opposed to the statewide attorney general. But to Christine's point, Hamadeh saying, look, you know, it's the attorney general's job to enforce the law, regardless of what you think about it.
Well, I think we need to understand what Chris Mays is saying, and I would have to agree with her in that the attorney general's job isn't just to enforce the laws that were made by the legislature, but also to make sure that those laws do not conflict with the law of the land, which in Arizona is our Arizona Constitution. And as Mays points out correctly, there is a portion in our state constitution that is, you know, in opposition to a complete and total ban. And that is that within our constitution, it's not within the U.S. Constitution, but within our state constitution, there is an expressed right to privacy. And what Chris Mays is saying is that, I mean, what could be more private than a decision a woman has to make about her body, a decision a woman has to make in consultation with her doctor? That is a very private, very confidential decision. And so what Mays is saying is that if something goes against, if the legislature creates a law that is in opposition to the state constitution, it is absolutely the attorney general's place to call that out and to say that, no, we cannot create a law that is in opposition to our Constitution. And that's what she's saying. And I think that that's really important, because we are actually seeing this same thing being debated in other states now that Roe v. Wade was overturned. We have other states that have a similar right to privacy within their state constitutions, and they're litigating this as well. And if she's the AG, she will take this on and she will litigate it up to the Arizona Supreme Court.
Christine, very quickly before we have to wrap up, we've seen, for example, just in the last month or so, Mark Brnovich declining to defend a state law dealing on filming police. We have seen attorneys general in the past decline to defend particular laws. Like, does the attorney general, should they maybe not have that ability? Should they be forced to defend the law regardless of what they think about it?
It's such an interesting question, and it's really more of an existential question about the role of the person in that job.
Right.
They are the state's lawyer. They are supposed to represent agencies of the state, including the governor. But I do think Julie makes a really good point, which is when there's a conflict, it does fall to the attorney general to clarify that. Now, the Supreme Court has said we didn't find a right of privacy in the U.S. Constitution. Arizona codified that, you know, decades ago. So does the right of privacy give women the right to an abortion? That is an issue for the Attorney General to get clarified. And it probably does need to go to the Supreme Court. But in the meantime, this trope about my opponent wants to put doctors, nurses, and pharmacists in jail for abortion care, you know, that I think is the wrong message for Chris Mayes. If she is an astute lawyer, I think she can rest on this discrepancy or the conflict between the Constitution and the law. And that is something that the Attorney General should get worked out.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Certainly much more on all of these issues. My thanks to Christine Jones, former gubernatorial candidate, and Julie Earfley of Earfley Uncuffed. Thanks to you both for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the King of the Rant is coming to Arizona. We'll hear from comedian Louis Black about why he thinks we're going off the rails. But first, with the rise of former President Donald Trump, we've seen Christian nationalism rise too, or at least come out into the open. A poll from Politico earlier this month showed a majority of Republicans favor declaring the United States a Christian nation. And for our next guest, it's a threat not just to democracy, but to religion. Reverend Jennifer Butler is a pastor in the Presbyterian Church and founder of the organization Faith in Public Life. She's also a leader in progressive Christianity. She'll be in Tempe this weekend at Dayspring United Methodist Church to talk about the threat of white Christian nationalism. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it, beginning with her own faith and why she thinks diversity must be at the center of it.
I grew up in a large church in the South in the Bible Belt, a large Methodist church, actually. And my family went to church three times a week. We had Sunday worship and Wednesday night supper and Bible study. So deeply, deeply involved in church. But as I came of age, I began to wonder, you know, is this a faith that I believe for myself? Is it just my parents' faith? Or am I, would I call myself a Christian? Do I dedicate myself to this faith? And I began to read the Bible for myself. And I was really struck as a teenager how much Jesus talked about people who were marginalized. At the time, I felt marginalized. I was worried about nuclear Armageddon. It was the height of the arms race. I was worried about racism in my community. And I really liked what I saw in Jesus. But to be honest, I didn't hear that Jesus preached in church.
So tell us a little bit about the journey that you took and deciding to become a pastor, deciding to really dedicate yourself to it in a real way.
Yeah, so I went to live overseas, actually. I had this kind of call based on the Bible to do justice and walk humbly with God, you know, in the world. And so I went into the Peace Corps in Central America, and I learned firsthand some of the terrible things that were happening, you know, in that region of the world, because of the U.S. government and some of our policies. And it kind of reworked the way I saw things. You know, got to go to seminary and started to put some language to my faith after that of liberation theology, of really understanding what scripture was about, rooted in God's liberation of the Hebrew people from slavery in Egypt. That's the cornerstone of everything. So I came to understand God as the God who liberates people from slavery and from oppression, and to live that faith out in the world by starting this organization that I founded, Faith in Public Life.
So in your work with Faith in Public Life, you're a leader in the progressive faith movement. I wonder, you know, how politics has informed your faith, or maybe it's the other way around.
Yeah, it's more than my faith has taken me into politics. You know, it's funny because growing up, I was really puzzled by politics. I saw in the 80s, all of my friends who were Christians getting kind of pulled into supporting Ronald Reagan. And I began to see this disconnect between the way people thought about their faith and the Jesus I knew, who said, I have come to bring good news to the poor and freedom to the oppressed, between that Jesus and the other Jesus that people were talking about that seemed to be a warmongering Jesus. I didn't understand that at all. That seemed to put America first, as opposed to seeing the whole earth, all of the people in the world as God's children. And so I grappled with that. And that took me into an arena where I started to really apply what I saw in the Bible. You know, there are over 2,000 verses in the Bible about poverty. There are hundreds of verses about welcoming the stranger. And yet a lot of my friends seemed, you know, to really be derogatory toward poor people, wanting to cut programs that would help people get out of poverty, denigrating immigrants, not welcoming of people of other faiths. And that didn't comport with what I saw in the Bible. So that turned me into an activist. I really wanted to put my faith in action, and I began to advocate for policies that were more grounded in the ethical principles of my faith and other faiths that I was getting to know more about.
So you're speaking out now about white Christian nationalism, which has been around for a very long time, but feels more present these days, maybe. First, tell us about some of the roots of this.
White Christian nationalism goes back a long way in this country. We actually, at the beginning of the country, we started in the slave trade, and we created a slave Bible to prevent slaves from rebelling and seeking freedom. We had to take the Bible and cut out the book of Exodus, the liberation of the Hebrew people from slavery in Egypt, because that story was inspiring slaves to revolt. So that right there is white Christian nationalism, and that sort of effort to hijack faith to oppress other people, or to put our nation above other people and legitimize mistreating others and dominating others, that has been with us from our inception. But we saw white Christian nationalism really resurge, in particular under the Trump administration, where Trump started to embrace this idea that America was a Christian nation, and to sort of legitimize those who were speaking to that concept.
What has that looked like within the world of Christianity for you? Like, are you seeing communities become divided? Are you seeing pastors grapple with this? What's the real world implications of this kind of rhetoric?
It's really hard, because I have pastors say to me, you know, QAnon has my people and I can't break through to them. Or Fox News, you know, has my people 24/7 and I only get them once or twice a week. It feels to them like people are sort of getting brainwashed and their fears are being tapped and they're being worked into a frenzy. And the really sad thing about this is that the faith itself is being warped, you know, into something that it's not. It's like a funhouse mirror. And so it's extremely damaging to people's souls, and it's a threat to our democracy.
So a lot of the rhetoric we hear and a lot of the pushback we hear against nationalism, white supremacy in the country right now comes from political spheres. Why do you think it's important for religious voices to get involved in that, and particularly Christian ones for you?
Well, I think Christians, particularly white Christians, have not understood scripture very well because of the history of white supremacy in this country. There is literally a theology created to justify slavery in the South. And that sort of pietistic, individualistic, apocalyptic faith persists to this day. And so I think it's up to white Christians to turn things around, to reason with our brothers and sisters in faith, and to help pull them back from the brink, both spiritually and religiously, but also in terms of our democracy and politically. There's so many people who are demoralized and leaving churches because of the intolerance and the bigotry they see. And so they're being harmed, but also people who are getting drawn down the rabbit hole of QAnon are also being harmed. They're living in fear, and that's not the way God wants us to live.
Lastly, Reverend, I want to ask you about the importance of diversity in faith from your point of view. It sounds like this is something you think needs to be embraced in a real way, and in a way that maybe we're not seeing very often in Christianity today.
Yeah, that's the enlivening thing about the vision in scripture. You know, it starts with this creation story in which God says every single person is created in God's image. That's an invitation to live together in love and in community and in God's abundance. And that's the vision God offers us, not this vision of somebody else is going to get more than I have, or, you know, I'm going to discriminate against somebody because they have a different color skin or a different sexuality. Let's create hierarchies where we can exploit people for power and greed. No, that's not the vision that God invites us into. It's this beautiful vision where we love one another and we're able to build the beloved community.
Right. Reverend Jennifer Butler, founder of Faith in Public Life, joining us. Reverend, thank you for coming on. I appreciate your perspective on this.
Thank you.
please say it again.
Tempe-based artist Safwat Salim is a visual artist whose work focuses on culture, loss, and belonging. He's also a sound designer, so when he began listening to our soapbox essays, he volunteered to tinker with a few true stories to see what he could add. The results have aired all week, background for essays that grapple with the theme of sorry. Today, we're putting Salim center stage as the week's final essay airs and asking him about his process and inspiration, beginning with why he wanted to do this in the first place.
And I was very excited about that possibility because I hear an audio story and I immediately start thinking about, all right, like, how can this come alive with music? Because it feels like such a, it's like a cheat code in audio stories. Like, so if you are saying something and you're going for an emotional impact, yeah, the words can do that. But if you want to get there way faster, just add the right music and the audience is with you.
Turns out the biggest challenge was holding back, particularly when he was working with Deborah Sussman's essay, which is set in a bar.
So, like, for example, Deborah's piece, there was this entire bar scene, and I was having fun with it. Like, I should add some sounds of bottles in there. How about, like, a drink being poured? And how, so it's, like, it's easy to go overboard.
Thursdays and Fridays at the club were always madness. Only time to take a customer's shouted order from the crush of bodies pressed against the railing, push the drink across the bar, slam their money in the till, and then next.
But then once you add all of those things, then I had to keep in mind, all right, is it taking away from the story? Because the story comes first. And so I actually took a lot of things away from Deborah's story while working on it.
Only time to take a customer's shouted order from the crush of bodies pressed against the railing, push the drink across the bar, slam their money in the till, and then next.
For Salim, this is all related to his own work in all the best ways.
I'd say that my visual art is mostly about storytelling as well. So I love a good story. And with these audio pieces, it felt similar that I was trying to tell a story through sounds instead of the visual medium.
Now let's hear our final essay from Tempe writer Paul Morris, with sound design, of course, from Safwat Salim.
Arizona has a lot of apologizing going on these days. People running for offices are going on apology tours. County election officials are apologizing for not printing enough ballots. Athletes and comedians are reaching for the sorry word. And then there are the Arizonans who refuse to apologize, ever. It's a John Wayne-like belief that apologies are a sign of weakness. Arizona has an I'm sorry law that allows physicians the chance to offer a sincere apology for a medical mistake. The idea is to create a safe conversation, maybe reduce anger, and most importantly, diminish the risk of a malpractice lawsuit. I get it. I've made many mistakes in my work, and always found that fessing up to them made me feel better. My bosses? Not so much. There are tearful apologies, heartfelt apologies, and sarcastic apologies. When I was young, my family played the board game called Sorry. It taught me the dark pleasures of the insincere apology. Whenever my piece landed on a square with my sister's piece, I could move her back to the start. I'd roll my eyes and chirp, "Sorry." The older you get, the more you think about apologies and reaching out. I wonder if it's helpful to the offended people to hear me, or if it's more about me seeking release from those memories. Check out The Hardest Word podcast. People own up to all sorts of misdeeds, and their voices are filled with raw emotion and a sense of relief. Eventually, you may hear a deathbed apology. People I've loved have taken a moment to recall an incident from long ago and tell me that they wished it had been different, usually over something that now seems trivial. Yet they had carried remorse over the years, and the effort had weighed them down. Just talking about it seemed cathartic. My car radio is filled with apologies, songs about misconnects suggesting the need to send in the clowns, that sorry seems to be the hardest word, asking forgiveness because you were always on my mind, assigning blame, it's a little bit mean and a little bit rude, power ballads that note it's hard to say I'm sorry, catchy ditties that wish they could turn back time. I can tell you that it isn't effective to say how I only wanted to see you in the purple rain. I tried it. It doesn't work. I have a lot to apologize for in this life, and whenever possible, I'm trying to do that. However, It's difficult to look up the people I knew and wronged in grade school, or high school, or college, or at the multitude of jobs I've held over the years, and all those I've loved. Sure, if I bump into Mike from third grade, I'm going to have a chat about my unkind words. So I'm putting everyone on notice that I'm going to talk with them soon. I truly am sorry.
That was Paul Morris. You can hear his essay again, as well as the rest of our Soapbox collection on the theme Sorry, at kjzz.org. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. There are comedians who talk about current events, and then there's Lewis Black. He's been called the king of the rant and has talked about what's on his mind on stage, on The Daily Show, and elsewhere. He's bringing his off-the-rails tour to Arizona this weekend. He'll be at the Fox Theater in Tucson tonight and the Celebrity Theater in Phoenix tomorrow night. I spoke with Black earlier, and we started with the name of his tour and whether there are specific things about which he thinks we're off the rails or if it's more of a general comment.
Everything. All of it. Madness. Complete madness. It's spectacular to watch. And yesterday, or the day before, I can't remember, I'm losing track of time, NASA sent out this rocket, and we bumped an asteroid off of orbit. And that we can do, and otherwise we apparently can't accomplish anything else. If we can do that, we can do anything. Wake up. I'm tired of it. It's exhausting.
Do you find that by making what you're talking about funny and trying to inject comedy, like, does that get people to think about things maybe in a way that they wouldn't if they read it in the newspaper or hear it on the radio?
I don't know. People let others decide that. I think that essentially, I go to a town and I do my stuff, and then, you know, you can go there the next day and they'll say nothing has changed. I mean, we don't change things. I think what is provided is a bit of insulation from the madness, so you can step back and go, oh, okay, I don't need to be involved with this all the time.
So I want to ask you about the podcast that you've been doing. And I'm curious, for somebody who is used to doing live shows in front of an audience, what is it like sort of recording by yourself? Like, is it weird not getting that instant feedback that you get when you're on stage?
Well, I mean, I did a bunch of those podcasts, rantcasts, as I call them, during the pandemic when I wasn't touring. And it wasn't weird to read the rants, because one of the reasons I started doing it was because it was the one way I could maintain a real direct contact with my comedy, because I know how to read a rant. I know how to make it funny. I don't need an audience for that. And I wasn't one of those people who's going to show up on Zoom or go to a drive-in movie theater or put myself in any kind of jeopardy in order to perform. And so it was a way in which I could perform. What was tough was the intros. Without the audience, doing those intros was brutal. But now that I'm back on the road, a lot of what I'm doing is that at the end, and I'll be doing it when I'm in Phoenix, is that at the end of the show, I do an hour show, and then I come back and I do 15 to 20 minutes, and then I do a chunk of talking about the area and stuff like that, or whatever my history is with Phoenix, or if something has come up that I want to talk about that I didn't talk about in the act. And then I launch into reading the rants written by folks who are either in the audience, who sent them in before, live in Arizona, or if there's something really topical or someone from another country sent something that I thought we should, would work, I start reading that. Then that's really been satisfying.
You know, I'm curious about the kinds of things that people are writing to you when you solicit their rants. Like, what are they writing about? The same stuff that you're thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it. Some of the times they say, yell about this stuff, and it's stuff I've already done in my act. They'll request that I rant, or they're things that they rant about. There's a lot occurring out there in terms of potholes and rotaries. They've been building rotaries in this country apparently during the pandemic, and people aren't happy about the rotaries.
That's so interesting that with everything going on in the world, people are ranting about rotaries.
Yeah, isn't that something? It's kind of extraordinary.
Wow.
But they also ran about, you know, a bit about the new president, a bit about the old president. The healthcare is a big issue. Women's rights is a big issue. Women's right to choose is a big issue. You know, if something hits during that week, usually someone or a few people will write about it. I will say what really is difficult is to try, you know, there's a more of a lean of the people writing in who are saying things that are, one would say were more in the Democratic camp. And I constantly ask people to write in about from the other side. And I have to say they don't.
Interesting. How are you finding it being back on the road in front of live audiences?
It's really good because that's my primary relationship. It is. You know, I chose a long time ago. I wrote about it. I chose my career at a certain point. And so leaving it was like, you know, not having, being able to go out there was horrifying.
Right. Well, so I'm curious about the response that you get from the audience. Obviously, people who are coming to see you, I would imagine many, if not all of them, know what you do and know sort of what to expect. But I wonder about the idea of sort of escapism and using entertainment and a night out as a way to sort of get away from all the other stuff going on in the world. That's not really what you get at a Lewis Black show.
Well, you get some of it. Because I'm kind of goofy. I mean, I do kind of have certain responses at times that, you know, I'm talking about something that's, you know, serious. And then I say something in response to that that's really stupid. It's like I said, I mean, here's the kind of the nature of the joke is that, you know, I discovered that health, you know, dealing with health and, you know, health and freedom are completely different things. Okay. And during the pandemic, we kind of made them, you know, intersect. And that was nonsense. And the reason we know that health and freedom are completely different is because they're spelt differently. Okay, so it's like, I don't come down on the, I'm not coming up with a diatribe. But to be honest, I do get people who don't know me.
Really?
And I've started my act now, since I've started back on the road, I do a thing at the beginning. It's like, you know, if you come to my show and you get upset, it's on you. It's not on me. You had plenty of opportunity to find me. If you go to see a thing with your kids, you go to see a movie, you read the review. You don't, in the middle of the movie, go, wow, I didn't know they killed everybody. I had a guy recently sitting next to somebody else in the audience. He turned to the person in the audience and said, I hope he doesn't swear.
Oh, boy.
Like, come on, guys.
All right. That is comedian Lewis Black performing tonight in Tucson, tomorrow night at the Celebrity Theater in Phoenix. Lewis, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate it. And I look forward to coming to Phoenix and talking about a few things. You guys, well, good luck out there. You've certainly got it rolling around.
You've got a few things on your mind about Phoenix, huh?
Oh, well, the state of Arizona. I think you guys are too close to the sun.
In theory, it'll get cool enough soon, right? Not so close to the sun. Anyway, that is it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being with us. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Have a great weekend. See you back here on Monday.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody and Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening today.